From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmaker Joseph LeBaron is interested in Mormon fringe groups. Recently, he's been embedded in a closed Facebook page of people who are part of a movement called Remnant. The Remnant believers are Mormons or former Mormons, and most of them are pretty literal in their beliefs about LDS scripture and the role of Mormon founder Joseph Smith. But they believe the original intention of Smith has been changed, has been altered by the mainstream LDS church. One of the first people to advance this idea is a man named Denver Snuffer. LeBaron says Snuffer is eloquent enough, but if you were to sit next to him on a plane, you would have no idea he's the guy who started this apostate movement that seems to be growing. Today in the program, we're talking about Denver Snuffer and his loose fellowship of disaffected saints. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's what seems to be the biggest challenge for this newish fundamentalist movement that's breaking off from the LDS Church. It's called various things. One of the things it's called is the Remnant Movement. And here's the challenge. They don't really have a structure, which is weird for fundamentalists who are often all about the rules and this line of authority. The Remnant believers are kind of loosey-goosey. They say you don't need authority. You don't need a temple. You don't really need a leader to take part. And you have to wonder how long an organization, if we even can call it that, can last that way. But the people who are part of this Remnant movement do have beliefs, quite specific ones, that Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, restored the true gospel of Jesus Christ and that he set about to give guidance to this loose confederation of believers. But over time, Smith's intent became distorted by the mainstream LDS church, that rather than a deeply spiritual endeavor, the church has become a corporation full of pointless rules and bureaucrats who have lost their way. It's probably not right to call Denver Snuffer the leader of this movement. They don't like the idea of leaders. But let's just say he's the man who seems to have gotten the ball rolling on this movement, and it seems like it might be growing. So today in the program, we're talking about Denver Snuffer's Remnant Movement. Joining us in the studio is Lindsay Hansen-Park, acting director of Sunstone. It's a progressive foundation that discusses Mormonism, if you don't know what Sunstone is. She's also host of a podcast called Year of Polygamy. And welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Joseph LeBaron is also with us. He's a good friend of ours, a filmmaker with a local production and marketing company called The Good Line. He's made a few films with us over the years. He also has a particular interest in Mormon fringe groups. He's been closely following a closed Facebook group of people who identify with this Remnant movement. So he has some thoughts about all of that. And Joseph, welcome to you.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, I guess I wanted to begin broadly. Lindsay, describe this movement. Did I say it about right? Loosey-goosey was kind of how I thought about it. Is that a wrong way to think about it?
No, I think that's accurate. I think there are some interesting things happening with this movement. So I follow fundamentalist groups, and one of the main, I think, commonalities between fundamentalists is the idea that the LDS church is, most fundamentalists would call it, out of order.
Yeah.
So this new Remnant movement is definitely in line with that, but most other fundamentalist groups that break off from what we call the Brighamite Church, the people that, you know, left Nauvoo, followed Brigham Young,
The Brighamite Church, is that what they say?
Well, that's what scholars would call it.
Okay.
So there's over 400 extant groups of the original church that Joseph Smith started. There's no such thing as the original church anymore. LDS people think that they have the original church. That's the tradition I come from. But the Brighamite movement is anyone that followed Brigham Young.
Yeah.
Most fundamentalists that follow the Brighamite tradition practice plural marriage in some form or another. So what's really unique about this movement is they not only don't practice plural marriage yet, but they are actually very much against it.
Yeah.
But they also, they align with this fundamentalist idea that the LDS Church is a corporation. They're just keeping the lights on. They're sort of out of order. That's not the the terminology they would use. It's like a progressive libertarian sort of modern fundamentalist group. And in many ways, I think that we are seeing what it would have been like to see the early church start. It's very, very messy, and it's very diverse and
very idealistic.
Very idealistic, very contradictory.
Yeah.
So I think your description was pretty apt.
You said in a podcast you had a conversation with one of these remnant movement. I don't even want to say followers. They
don't like that word.
They hate that word. But someone in this movement. And you said that there was something about this brand of fundamentalism that kind of excited you. Not that you believed in this, but what, that you found it refreshing, different?
Yeah. So, I mean, I need to state right off the bat, I'm not a polygamist, never have been, and I'm not a follower of this movement. However, you know, in my podcast, listening to sort of their passion and their belief system, it's really compelling to me. And I think, first of all, Mormon doctrine is very heady in general. And so the traditional story of fundamentalism is you're going through the church, the LDS church, you're looking for something more, you discover old frontier doctrine. Mm-hmm. It's very seductive. And so you sort of move towards the fundamentalist groups. This group speaks to a different part of my soul, which is this sort of progressive, almost liberal idea that the gospel is for everyone. It's very democratic. And so what this movement says is you don't have to have a mediator between you and God. Yeah. You don't have to go to your bishop and talk about your sex life. You can go directly to God. Your relationship to God is important, and authority is misunderstood and actually used to abuse people. And I, you know, I've been in this community for 10 years doing, you know, the work with faith crises and things like that. And I've seen this. I've seen abuse of authority. I've seen bishops hurt people and abuse people. So it speaks to me on that level that this idea that you don't answer to anyone but God, I think that that's a really compelling idea.
I want to come back to what you might see as the parallels between the sort of progressive movement and this one. Because I think they're very similar, as you say.
Yes.
But it seems like they're incredibly different, too.
Yes.
In some ways. We'll get back to that. Joseph, I wanted to get your sense of this just broad, general, as you've been looking at these Facebook posts and the way people are talking. How do you describe what you're seeing?
Oh, there's a wide spectrum of beliefs. I've heard some people refer to it as sort of like Islam, where imams kind of, you know, rise up, but there's no real prophet, and anyone can and definitely there's a libertarian aspect to this. People want religion on their own terms, like a decentralized religion.
Libertarian.
Yeah.
But do they have a – have you been able to identify as you're looking around in this, and Lindsay, you too, but Joseph, you first, like an ideology? Like I have to say, I have a hunch that they're preppers, that they're kind of conservative, but I might be wrong about that. I don't think I'm right about that.
I think you'll get some people that believe that and some people that don't. And that's the crazy thing about this is right when you think that you might get a sense of what the core belief is, you realize that people can access it depending on what gap they're feeling in their faith. Mm. People access it. In a way, it's like some people do have polygamous leanings, and then there are other people who access this because they don't like how the Mormon Church's stance on gay marriage, and so you have maybe
both of those ideas fit into this.
From people I've talked to, you're talking about opposite ends of the spectrum.
What have you noticed? Do you see a political ideology in there?
So I talked to Denver last night and yesterday. He was kind enough to talk to me. He's a pretty down to earth guy, and I said, okay, what is like the fundamental principle of your movement? And the very first thing he said was, he said religion should make you uncomfortable. This idea that religion should not be a money making venture. If I were to,
which he says that mainstream LDS church is,
of course, so here's the paradox of the entire thing. Like Joseph just said, it's diverse and there's a lot of room for different thoughts. But I would say the common thread that runs through the entire group right now would be an anti-hierarchical belief. So that is like the if you could say, the core principle. That is what Denver tried to reiterate over and over and over again. So he was saying, you know, if religion should be a sacrifice, and if you are being, if it's lining your pockets, it's not a sacrifice, it should be taking from you, not giving to you. And I thought that that was a really interesting idea. And another thing that I think is really interesting and hard for my brain to wrap around, because like I said, I come from the LDS tradition, which is very hierarchical, patriarchal.
Line of authority.
Line of authority. The way that they talk about priesthood, the way that they talk about structure, they use the same terminology that I'm familiar with. And yet they've radically redefined the words in ways that I think are kind of brilliant, but also very confusing and hard for me to wrap my brain around.
I want to come back to that, too. We're going to come back to all this stuff. But let's explain who Denver Snuffer is. And what makes him so special? It seems like there are a number of people who think like he does. His ideas of the original, the mainstream LDS church now going astray, that is by no means original. A lot of people, as you have said, that happens a lot. But why is Snuffer, is he particularly charismatic? Why does he sort of stand out? Is it just that he's the one, as I said, who got the idea going?
So one of the main misunderstandings, I think, about fundamentalists that I have come to terms with, growing up as an LDS girl, I'm sort of taught to look at all these other extant groups as wicked or wrong or power hungry or whatever. Really, the truth is the people that start fundamentalist movements are probably the most devoted to the church. And Denver is no different. And so Denver was just this average guy on the LDS program, you know, going through his church experience. He went to J. Reuben Clark Law School. He was going to do what all Mormon men do. You want to become a lawyer so you can provide for your family. And
he's a convert, we should say, too.
He was a convert, but very devoted to the faith, very loyal to the church, I would say, very loyal to the gospel, and the scriptures interested him. And there's this long tradition in Mormonism of parlor and home literature that starts all the way back with Orson Pratt. It was the church, like, encouraged regular members to start writing books. So Denver did that. I mean, I think at this point it's like 13 books he's written now. And some of them were said to be sold at Desert Book. And so,
is that true, though?
You know what? I haven't been able to verify. I tried to look that up.
Yeah, that's the thing that's and that's one thing I do want to ask you about. So he wrote this book, and the first one is The Second Comforter, mm-hmm. which will have meaning for Orthodox Mormons and people who are familiar with Mormonism. We don't need to get into that, although we can get into some of the ideas. But it was a book that you've said resonated with a lot of mainstream Mormon leaders. Maybe not leaders at the top of the hierarchy, but Lindsay, you've talked about how stake presidents and bishops were actually sharing this book.
Yeah. So again, here's how the story goes. The story goes, you're sitting in your LDS ward and, you know, you go to church every week and it's great and you like it, but maybe your child has died, or maybe you have this deep conflict or question that you need to take to the Lord and you don't feel like you're getting an answer. So oftentimes LDS people, when they need higher level of spiritual ministering, they'll go to their priesthood leaders, their bishop or their stake president. And what I've heard, and Joseph, you can maybe verify too, a lot of people will go to their bishop with the questions or their stake president, and you know, in sort of whispered tones, they'll say, well, listen, we don't give this to everybody, but this is sort of the higher law, the deeper spiritual understanding. It's too sacred. So, you know, we don't talk about it in sacrament meeting. And they would pass this book. And, you know, it's Denver Snuffer's experience with what, as he calls it, conversing with the Lord through the veil. And I would say it's actually very much in line with the LDS sort of viewpoint. At least it started out that way.
Yeah. And we should also explain, and Joseph, I'm not sure how much you know about this part of the story, but I don't want to call him a prophet, although I think some may think of him as a prophet, but as a lot of prophets do, like throughout history, he has this kind of Muhammad moment, right? Mm. Like where he sees Jesus?
Yeah. Not only does he see the Lord, but it's different than, like, maybe Joseph Smith or Muhammad. He's also told that others can see it too, that there's nothing special about this in the sense that he is not unique, that the Lord wants to converse with people. The Lord wants to meet people face to face. And I think that when you are in, your LDS ward and you're looking for a higher meaning and purpose, the idea that Jesus Christ wants to see you in person, mm-hmm. you got to think that that's really, really compelling.
Do people say that they've seen Jesus Christ in those Facebook groups?
All the time.
All the time.
Oh, when I first joined the group, I asked just straight up for some clarification, and my inbox got blown up, and most of them have been conversing with Jesus. And I think that's kind of the interesting thing is, if you look at the traditional Mormon faith, you know, there's a lot, you know, they talk about personal revelation, and they're really just using that. So they're not even using something that is counter to, I think, what's taught traditionally.
It's a big belief within Mormonism that you have access to God, right? You could technically do it, but no one ever does.
No, but
right?
It's just that this Facebook group happens to have a lot of people that
talk
to Jesus.
Right, yeah. Right. Which means what, do you think?
Well, I mean, I should say that when I went to this group and as I started to dig into it, it wasn't truth seeking. It was just sheer curiosity.
Yeah.
So I don't want to degrade anybody's beliefs or anything.
No.
If I were to take a guess at it, I think people are just missing something. They feel incomplete within the traditional Mormon faith. For whatever reason, and because of that wide spectrum that so many people can come to this from so many angles. So really, it's as diverse as every individual in the movement.
Yeah. It seems like, Lindsay, there is this idea, and it may be true, and I wanted to get that the origins of Mormonism, especially in the day when Joseph Smith was alive and interacting with Latter-day Saints, that it was a much more mystical, ecstatic kind of faith, that Smith and others encouraged members to have their own experiences with divinity, and that as the church became more mainstream, a lot of that was kind of stripped away. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's one of the main arguments in most fundamentalist groups. So when you look at the early church, I mean, these are my ancestors, my people. In the Kirtland Temple, they are seeing angels. They're speaking in tongues. I mean, glossolalia and all of that, I've never even witnessed. And I think if someone were to get up in a ward house today and start talking in gibberish, we would all say, call the police.
Yeah.
That's where these... That's where our people come from. I mean, someone once recorded seeing a heavenly steamboat fly over Kirtland Temple, and everyone is witnessing saying, yes, I see it too, I see it too. So we have that, and we have this long tradition of Mormon women blessing and healing one another, getting together and doing all of these things. You know, Joseph's family was known for being into magic. His mother was, she would find, you know, have the divining rods to seek water, and
she was a dowser,
yep. and she was and like what they would call an herb witch at the time. She was into herbs and things like that. Nowadays, you know, that stuff is completely looked down upon. It's seen as evil and satanic. But this is how Joseph Smith would have understood his world, and so a lot of fundamentalists are a lot more flexible when it comes to mystical experiences. And I think that appeals to people, because what we have is, we in the origins of our faith, we have the promises of these great, you know, sort of Pentecostal experiences, but we don't really have an outlet in the current, like, correlated, you know, LDS church right now.
That it's too rigid. It's become too rigid or something.
I mean, you could say it's too rigid. I understand, of course, like, so the podcast I do covers the history of Mormon polygamy from, you know, the beginning until now. And when you see what they're trying to do, they're really trying to gain control of this doctrine of plural marriage. And so, in my opinion, in order to do that, they've had to really strip away some of the really fantastical things about Mormonism, Adam God theory, and all these things that made Mormonism peculiar and unique. And with those doctrines come the ability to practice spiritually. And it's kind of a dangerous idea in a hierarchical church if you have people claiming personal revelation and blessing each other and raising the dead. If they have the authority to do that, what does that say about your authority as a hierarchical church?
Wait, so your theory is, this is interesting. So what you're saying is that if it weren't for polygamy and the church trying to sort of back away from that idea and that practice, modern-day Mormonism might be a more mystical experience?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, but again, I'm the crazy person on the Hill being like, it's all about polygamy.
Yeah. Well, you do have a podcast about it. Yeah.
Well, so I do. So if you look at other traditions that weren't Brighamite, that didn't come across the plains and do the whole pioneer thing, they have remained to be in line more with mainstream Christianity, very like sort of Protestant. We have polygamy, and polygamy sort of transforms the church in so many ways that it's really hard to pinpoint. But once it goes away, the most interesting thing in the early 1920s and 30s, people think that polygamy ended and it just went away, right? It didn't. Even apostles were marrying people, and, you know, even 6 years after the manifesto, the president of the church, Wilford Woodruff, marries plurally. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away. But eventually the federal government's like, you guys said you were done with this. You're not done. And the church really had to crack down on getting rid of this stuff. But what it meant was this was a doctrine that was taught as like the highest order, the celestial order. And people knew that. They remembered hearing it. They remembered hearing it from Brigham Young and John Taylor. And now these same people who taught that to them earlier saying, we can't do this anymore. So this becomes the tension and authority that we're talking about. Now they know these men, these brethren, the leaders of the LDS Church have this conflict of interest, right, of keeping the lights on and abandoning the doctrines. So that's traditional fundamentalism. And this movement, the remnant movement, follows that idea. They say, wait a minute. We have some of these original ideas. Why don't we talk about lectures on faith anymore?
But they ditched the polygamy part.
Well, which is where Denver and I jump off. We disagree on this.
Yeah. So explain that. So I can't figure out, with all the, it seems like, pretty clear evidence that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, even the mainstream LDS church, which wants to protect the reputation of Joseph Smith, has come out and a high-profile essay that we've talked about in this program, he practiced elements of polyandry, married wives who are already married, married at least one girl who was 14 years old. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what the case would be against that not being the case, that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, believed in polygamy, introduced the concept of polygamy. But Denver Snuffer says it's not so.
Yes, and this is a big point of contention between me and my remnant friends, and I apologize to my remnant friends on this, but I just what they have done is so let's back up to when what we call the Saints leave Nauvoo, the Brighamite Church comes across. Emma Smith stays back. She becomes a polygamy denier, and there's this really interesting history with her son, Joseph Smith III, and his cousin, Joseph F. Smith, who was Hiram Smith's son, and they have this fight for the rest of their lives on Did Joseph Smith Jr. practice polygamy? And Joseph Smith III comes out to Utah several times. He really wants to know, is his mom telling the truth or are other people telling the truth? We have a lot of documentary evidence from that. The church that Joseph Smith III starts becomes so invested in anti-polygamy. It's as if, as much as the Brighamite Church was invested in polygamy, they were not.
Yeah.
So they have a century of arguments against it.
Yeah.
Denying it.
And Snuffer's using those.
The remnant movement is taking all of this
But there's no doubt. Is there any doubt? Is there any doubt that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy? I mean, come on.
I will give them this. The only doubt is there's not contemporary evidence in Joseph Smith's hand where Joseph Smith admits, hey, I married all these people. And I, in my opinion, that is more damning than anything else, because if you look at all of the existing evidence surrounding Joseph, it's overwhelming. And it's suspicious that, like, why would, oh no, all of Joseph's friends are practicing polygamy and on trial for adultery, but not him. To me, that's evidence. However, they say that it's not. I mean, it's been corrupted, and Brigham Young forced these women to get in line and sort of, you know, perpetuate his narrative.
What are you hearing about polygamy? Do they talk about that much?
It comes down to the individual. Like, some people think that it's the highest order. It's like where we're going.
So you still hear that?
Yeah. Other people are like, no, that's not what I believe.
Let me play a clip. This is a Denver snuffer, actually. I'm not sure what the context for this is, actually. This is I think this is the speech at Sunstone, is it not? Yes, Elaine is telling me. This was a speech at the most recent Sunstone where Denver snuffer gave a talk. And he talks about this idea of polygamy. Let me play this moment and we can talk about it.
The scatterling polygamous sects are hardly Mormon at all, practicing what the Book of Mormon identifies as an abomination that has broken the hearts of wives and lost the confidence of their children. All forms of institutional Mormonism are easily compromised because they have all adopted a structure engineered by Brigham Young. Joseph established at least four bodies equal in authority, making it impossible for one to rule and reign with blood and horror over others. Brigham destroyed that balance and promptly began to reign with blood and horror. He even succeeded in persuading Mormons to openly...
Okay, so we get the point. He goes on and on. But the idea is that this was Brigham Young who started all of this. And I'm just trying to get a sense from you about whether that, I guess you said it, that does it really hold much water, the idea that this was Brigham Young's idea? And I guess the thing I was interested in is, it seems like Brigham Young is really the bad guy for these people. He's the one that really started to corrupt these pure intentions.
Yes, and that's the other thing that separates them from other, you know, fundamentalists, because a lot of them revere Brigham Young. To the polygamy question, I would say universally, almost every credible scholar accepts that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. There are varying interpretations of how that happened, but every credible scholar, and I would say even ones that had a lot to lose to admit that, have admitted that, including the RLDS, now Community of Christ. They've had to grapple with that. That was their whole narrative. Denver and many of his followers know the scriptures really, really well. I would say what they know less is the history of how, you know, DNC 132 comes about, or how
Explain what that
Jacob...
is. No one's going to know what that is.
Okay, so in our Mormon canon, in our scriptures, we have the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price, and we have the Doctrine and Covenants. It was meant to be sort of a living document where continuing revelation, the idea that the heavens are open and God would speak and we would record these new scriptures. And so the early saints practice this, and the Remnant Movement is practicing this, and Community of Christ still practices this. The LDS Church has not added to the Doctrine and Covenants in many, many, many years, which is, of course, evidence of their apostasy to many fundamentalists. DNC 132 is what we call the celestial marriage revelation. Now, the LDS Church has interpreted it now in modern days to mean, you know, temple marriage and getting sealed in the temple for eternity. It's the Mormon marriage system. Early saints would have understood it to be plural marriage. I mean, the history of it was established in an effort to convince Emma Smith to practice plural marriage. And so there's this long kind of crazy history with it. It wasn't even incorporated into the official DNC for a while. And so the Remnant Movement will say, well, that's evidence that, you know, Joseph Smith never signed off on it. It was recorded. There were two copies. One was destroyed. Emma Smith allegedly threw one in the fire. And so they say, you know, we don't have this in Joseph Smith's actual hand. So it was forged by someone else. Yeah. That's not all we have. We have the scripture that Denver is quoting in Jacob, in Book of Mormon, that condemns polygamy. There's an entire history of the creation of this. And scholars didn't just invent this. I mean, they've been studying the influence of Joseph Smith for years and years and years. Yeah. So, but like Joseph said, there are polygamists that are becoming attracted to this, and it's presenting a conflict.
Well, I want to get to that too, the idea of what kind of conflicts. If you have an organization that has no structure, basically, that is fairly loose with these rules, who do you allow in? And what does the in even mean? We'll get to that when we get back from a break. We have Lindsay Hansen Park, acting director of Sunstone, host of the podcast Year of Polygamy. Joseph LeBaron, he's a filmmaker with the marketing and local production company The Good Line, with us. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this movement of disaffected Mormons that seems to be growing. It's not the group of progressive Latter-day Saints you might be familiar with, the ones who question the origin story of their church and some of its policies. This is a more kind of conservative, original group, I guess, who firmly believe actually in Joseph Smith's ideas. Their spin, though, is that the mainstream LDS church has strayed from Smith's intentions. So we're talking about this with Lindsay Hansen-Park, acting director of Sunstone and host of the podcast Year of Polygamy, and Joseph LeBaron. He's a filmmaker who lives here in Utah. He's with the production company The Good Line. So let's talk a little bit about the differences between the kind of progressive group of disaffected Mormons who have problem with the origin story. They don't believe this Book of Mormon thing was a literal thing. They, you know, you hear the stories of Joseph Smith translating these golden plates. They think, yeah, I probably didn't have golden plates, that he created this story. I mean, that at least that element is very different from these this progressive group in that sense. So what are the similarities, I guess, and mostly what are the distinctions between those groups?
So like I said, I've been in this sort of faith crisis, faith transition community for about a decade now. And the usual path that people follow are they're going along with the Mormon program, going through their church experience. Either something happens that doesn't jive with the doctrine, you know, they have a conflicting experience, or they stumble upon what we would call as Mormons anti-Mormon literature, right? Yeah. It's always anti-Mormon literature. And anti-Mormon literature actually just means usually historical evidence that doesn't square up with the traditional heritage narrative that we're taught in the LDS Church. And so people feel disillusioned. They feel lied to. They feel betrayed by their leaders. And when they go to their family and friends about it, they're like, you can't talk about this. You're being wicked. You're being led astray. And it creates this anger and pain. And a lot of people become atheists or whatever. They go off on their own path. The similarities that I think are really interesting is you'll talk to a lot of these remnant believers. And it's the same story, right? Same sort of origin story. And up until you say, so do you not believe in the Book of Mormon? No, it's a literal history. They believe it's a literal history. Yeah. Or they believed, like, so all the problems with history and all the church lies, you can chalk up to Brigham Young. Joseph Smith had nothing to do with it. He was sort of the purest form of pure religion.
But they believe there was a race of Jews who came
yes.
here and began a civilization in America.
No, like Joseph said, there's diversity of thought and they allow for diversity of thought. But, you know, I was talking to some of the panelists we had at Sunstone are people of color, a man of Hawaiian descent and a woman with in a native tribe. I forget the one that she's associated with. They absolutely believe the literal story. They believe themselves to be descendants of Lamanites, which I found very interesting. And I said, but you guys, you know, you read your stuff. I know you guys aren't dumb. You've read all of the, you know, DNA evidence and the, you know, the anti-historical arguments. And they said, yeah, and we can combat them all. So
okay, so they're in on that.
They're in,
on
so I think it's
there
easy.
Were swords and there were horses and there was.
Yep, and they feel like they can accurately explain that. Now, that is to say, let's say that you, Doug, were compelled by this democratic gospel and you wanted to join and you didn't believe it, there's absolutely a place for you.
They'd say it's cool. You can still
They'd say, like, we don't agree with you, but
you're in.
But
you're in.
Like, come okay. have brunch with us.
Do we have a sense, and can you tell whether or not the Mormon Church itself, the mainstream LDS Church, is worried about this group?
I mean, I would say absolutely yes. So
really?
Without revealing too much, people send me stuff from time to time. I've been sent a lot of documents, leaked documents from the LDS Church. These would be apostles writing to area authorities or to stake presidents or vice versa. There are huge, I mean, and some of the documents I have are from like 2014, but huge areas, and I don't want to say which areas, but huge areas in the Wasatch Front in Idaho where whole stakes are in danger of apostatizing. I mean, we're talking whole stakes. We haven't seen something like this since like the early frontier period with Brigham Young. This idea that the stake presidents are like on board for this. So there's a worry about that, so much so that it said that it was a Del Nate jokes for the Boise rescue.
Yeah.
So they sent the one of our apostles, LDS apostle, up to Boise for what we term now the Boise rescue to warn against Denver Snuffer. I mean,
wow.
Denver Snuffer, like he would hate, and I believe that this is sincere, he doesn't like the focus to be on him. So he would hate that we talk about him in this way, but he can go to, I'm an event organizer. I plan events. It's hard to get people to fill a room. Denver Snuffer can tell you, I'm going to be somewhere tomorrow in like the Marriott Center, you know, conference room filled up within like minutes. I mean, I've never seen people so attracted
Why?
To this movement. I think it's
no offense, Denver, who may be listening,
sure.
But and when you listen to that clip, for example, he doesn't exactly sound like the most charismatic guy in the world. I'm not saying he can't deliver a good speech, but
sure.
What is the deal?
I think he's, first of all, Mormons were permission-based people, right? Like we need permission for everything. I think he gives people permission to claim their faith in a way that makes sense to them. And I think that that's really compelling. I mean, we are so used to prophets, leaders looking like suit and tie and like sort of this bureaucratic business sense. That's sort of how Mormons have seen, you know, ever since like the 1950s, we've seen our leadership. Early prophets were radicals. They were strange. They were unusual. And they were sort of, I don't know, average in a way. And that's their appeal, right? That God would speak through an average man. I mean, this is the story of Joseph Smith.
And here's a lawyer from
Here's
Idaho
just this regular lawyer guy just doing his thing.
This is
just
the point you made, Joseph, that if you were to sit next to him on a plane, you wouldn't sense that he had an aura around him necessarily.
Yeah, and I think that that's the thing that people really connect with over is this when I think it was like a few maybe years ago he said, I don't want your women, I don't want your power, I don't want your money. And so people are like, oh, this is a guy who really doesn't really want to lead anybody. And then also he's giving us permission to talk to Jesus. He's like saying it's okay for you to.
I talk to Jesus and you can too.
Yeah.
Let me play a clip. This is from Adrian Larson, who spoke at the Sunstone Symposium this past weekend. He and his wife actually spoke as part of the symposium. They're part of this group of remnant believers. And I want to play this because it gets to this question that we were talking about. Here's Adrian Larson.
The overarching goal of this movement is to preserve and continue the restoration initiated by Joseph Smith. It ultimately failed in Joseph's day, but now that the required third and fourth generations have passed, the Lord has started his work again, with an eye toward completing it this time. But recovering and continuing what Joseph taught can be challenging for a couple of reasons. First, the records kept during Joseph's life are incomplete and messy, and though there are hints and intimations of what might have come had Joseph lived to see the restoration completed in its fullness, there is no certain roadmap. All indications are that the restoration was only just beginning when Joseph and Hiram were killed. Therefore, revelation will be required to continue what he started.
Revelation from who?
I think revelation, this is the tension in Mormonism. We have this idea of authority from God, but also personal revelation. And that tension of personal revelation and authority has caused Mormonism probably the biggest headache ever, because that's why we have so many groups. I think what Denver is saying is revelation is given to all. And this would be in line.
But Adrian sounds like he's saying we're going to have someone to reveal the word of God to continue this work. It can't just be a hodgepodge of anyone who wants to reveal whatever they want to do in order to get this work done. Joseph Smith was a prophet. Don't these guys think that Denver Snuffer is a prophet?
They do. But again, the term prophet through our LDS lens would be, you know, this top-down sort of speaking, you know, I give you authority and you have to listen. The way that I understand the structure, and I apologize if I'm misrepresenting this, but it's similar to Community of Christ, this idea of a prophetic people. So God speaks to the people, there becomes a movement, and then the people bring it back up to the leader, if there is one, and they decide. And this is how Denver does things. So there's a movement underway right now. There's an initiative where they're trying to rewrite Doctrine and Covenants 20. And for those who don't know, that's about the organizational structure and governance of how a church should be run. So they are rewriting it. And what they do is they have fellowships is what they call them. And they're like congregations or wards all around the world. And each fellowship takes this question. And what do we think that this should look like, this movement should look like? And they all decide. And then they bring it together at their general meetings. And they're going to have one, I think, this Saturday, the one's coming up.
They have them all over, though.
They have them all over. But they're going
So they're writing a constitution, basically.
They would not call it that.
I know they wouldn't, but that's
governing principles.
I know, but see, that's the thing that I feel like I need to push back on. They're saying, no. It doesn't really matter. Anyone can receive revelation, but in order for this work to be continued, revelation is going to need to be received. Adrian Larson said it. I'm sure he was thinking about Denver Snuffer. Someone's going to have to be in charge of this group. And we should also point out, it's not really a loose collection of people who believe whatever they want to believe if they have certain requirements. I mean, they are expected to be baptized. I mean, they don't believe baptism will make you a member of anything, but you have to be baptized to go to heaven. They're expected to believe salvation comes through Jesus Christ. That's a requirement. So, you know, they say, well, if you don't believe this stuff, it doesn't really matter. But there are expectations in this group of believers that you have to believe certain things to be legitimate. And here's the other thing. They're expected to be ordained to the priesthood, and women cannot have this priesthood. So much for that progressive ideal, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I actually asked Denver about that yesterday. I said, you know, because I run with all kinds of different Mormons, and so I'm very familiar and have friends in the ordained women movement. And so, you know, equity for women is important to me. So I asked him about this, and he has a very gender essentialist idea still that how he explained it to me is men represent knowledge and women represent wisdom, and knowledge and wisdom need to be united. It's a very sort of monogamous.
As a feminist, does that drive you nuts?
It's really.
Because what they're saying is here's the justification for why you can't hold the priesthood. I'll put you on a pedestal and make you feel good.
Well, and wisdom is sort of this when you compare wisdom with knowledge, like I like wisdom. I'm down with wisdom. but the way that we talk about it, it's like this sort of head pat, like, well, knowledge is like the basic foundation, but women are better. We're better. We're going to put you on a pedestal because you're wiser.
When I saw Adrian Larson talk about this at Sunstone, looking at the transcript, he said the stuff that you hear a lot from mainstream LDS church members about women getting the priesthood or not being able to have the priesthood, and that is that, no, they're there to support the men.
Mm.
They're there to be right behind the men. That doesn't seem much different from mainstream.
So Denver explained that the priesthood is different than how the LDS would understand it, that it's a priesthood, like a brotherhood.
I know, but
and so
what?
Women could have a sisterhood.
Okay.
And so they can bless.
But they can't have the priesthood.
But they can't baptize. So they can't perform ordinances. So there's a distinction between ritual and ordinances for them. So, and this I'm still trying to make sense of. So women can have a sisterhood, a priestesshood, and they can claim this. However, right now they don't believe that God has revealed that women can do that, but that's not their role. And I said, well, where does this leave, you know, transgender people or people?
Where does it?
I mean,
what about the LGBT members that, again, this is part of that progressive group of disaffected
Mormons?
So this
is so hard because when you talk to people, this is your instinct is you want to sort of sell it like we're open-minded. And I have heard, you know, varying things.
Yeah, I know, so, but what does he say? What does Denver say?
Denver said at the end of the day, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting, this is what he explained to me yesterday. At the end of the day, biology is fixed. And
so that's a mainstream LDS belief,
and
too.
And he didn't say biology. He said gender is fixed, not biological sex,
so
gender.
So there's a kind of conservative
and you
notion.
Have to choose.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Joseph, let me get your sense of this and what you think about as you see this kind of loose collection of different ideas all over the place. Give me just a quick sense of what you think. Like, would there what would they do differently? Would there be blacks in the priesthood, for example? Can we say definitively that – you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I want to see that alternate timeline where polygamy doesn't go away in the Mormon church to see if it does keep some of that early sort of mysticism.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that's the only way you could accurately say, because there are so many varying viewpoints within the movement. And I think that's...
Are there some, let me just ask you this way, are there some who believe blacks should not have the priesthood?
Yes, 100%.
Wow.
Yeah. And which is, again, crazy, because then you'll talk to someone else who will say, I joined this movement because I don't like the Mormon church's stance on gay marriage. And that's such a progressive, like, liberal belief. And then you have this other side where it's like, blacks shouldn't have the priesthood. And it's mind-blowing. And so how do you pin them down? And that's why they're a religion, but they're not a religion. They're not a religion, but they're a fellowship.
Yeah.
It's slippery.
I don't want to sound flippant here, but do they drink coffee, these people?
It depends.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So what is one of the things that they might do differently is get rid of the restrictions in the so-called word of wisdom, these dietary prohibitions.
I'm not trying to mock here, but honestly, if it's up to personal revelation, I mean, why couldn't you? You know, couldn't you also be a transgender person and have a personal revelation? And then wouldn't they have to respect that? If they believe in the power of personal revelation, you know?
What do you say? What does Denver say to that?
I would say he would agree with that. He would say you absolutely can. I think when it comes to these governing principles that they're trying to establish, that is where it gets murky. So your fellowship can do whatever you want. Like, I can get together and say, like, I want to have a polyamorous fellowship and, you know, we're all wife swapping. I don't know. So that's what we're doing. And we want to do this. Would we be accepted to their meetings? Yes. Would, if I tried to move forward that principle and say, I think everybody should be polyamorous, I wouldn't have any luck. And so there are governing principles. I agree with you.
So they do have boundaries.
They do have boundaries. And I will say that my lens, watching these fundamentalist movements throughout the long, you know, the short lens of Mormon history, which is like 200 years, it's always the same story, which is, listen, guys, and Brigham Young did the same thing when he gets the authority with the succession crisis. I'm not Joseph Smith, could never be Joseph Smith. I'm not a prophet. Don't call me a prophet. I'm not a leader. And by the time they make it to Utah, he's calling himself king of the world, you know? And so to me, I'm suspicious of that idea because I've seen it. I mean, it always starts with someone saying, listen, it's not me. Like, it's about all of us. But I just don't know how you can escape forming
an organization.
It follows
a pattern, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't know how you
can't. Let's take a break, and I want to. Then we'll come back for some final thoughts. Lindsay Hansen Park is with us, acting director of Sunstone, host of a podcast called Year of Polygamy. We'll put a link to it on our website. And Joseph LeBaron is with us, of course, filmmaker with The Good Line. It's a local production and marketing company. Has a particular interest in Mormon fringe groups. One day I'm going to get him on here and talk about his great uncle, part of the LeBaron clan. Is that okay with you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Let's take a break, and we'll come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Okay, we are. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation. We're talking about Denver Snuffer. He's one of the I want to say leaders, but again, that's one of the things that we've been talking about. But he's certainly one of the originators of this remnant movement. Let me play a moment from this is Tasha Larson again. Tasha is Adrian Larson's wife. She was excommunicated along with her husband, Adrian, because of their role and involvement in this remnant movement. She spoke at the Sunstone Symposium over the weekend.
The Lord has set his hand again the second time. He has called a servant into the vineyard who has done as the Lord commanded him. Other servants are being called. Labor is commencing, and the natural fruit is beginning to appear again in the vineyard. This is the last time labor will be done in the vineyard before it is burned. The Lord desires that a people rise up and through his grace and mercy become a righteous branch of the house of Israel, so the kingdom of God may come, the Lord's promises to the fathers may be fulfilled, and Zion may be established.
So the kingdom of God may come, and the vineyard, this is the last time all of this is going to happen before the vineyard is burned. Isn't that a trope you hear all the time from all kinds of religious leaders, that this is the last time, God is coming, it's just around the corner? I mean, the argument is that Jesus believed that, that Paul believed that, certainly that Joseph Smith believed that. And now you're hearing this from some of these remnant believers that this is the last time, folks. That seems pretty conventional, too.
Yeah, and that's the thing about prophecy, right? It's like consistently repackageable, and you can say, you know, the world's going to end. And we see this with all fundamentalist movements, like, you know, Warren Jeffs predicted the end of the world. Joseph Smith said to have predicted the end of the world in 1890, and when it doesn't happen, you have a convenient out, which is, you know, the believers did something wrong. Someone was, you know, watching a rated R movie. I don't know. I would say that it's less doom and gloom, but they really do see themselves as restoring the restoration, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you see this headed somewhere? Like, do you see a trajectory like that there's a kind of momentum picking up? Or what do you notice, Joseph?
Either Denver becomes prophet and it solidifies.
Yeah.
He doesn't become prophet and it fractures into so many groups because of so many different personal revelations. I just can't see it existing how it is right now for too much longer. It's religious chaos.
What do you think, Lindsay? Because that seems like that's the message of Brigham Young. A lot of people are saying that, I mean, he ruled with an iron fist, right? He brought structure to this disparate mystical group of people, and he made it succeed. So how do you, if you don't impose some kind of structure, sustain it?
I mean, I agree with Joseph, but I would also say that I think that it will go on longer than we probably think that it would, because we've seen fundamentalist movements. I mean, the Council of Friends, the origins of the main polygamous groups, lasted for decades.
Yeah.
I think people are really committed to this and really passionate, and this gives them an outlet. So, but I agree. I think that it's inevitable. I think these guys are living out the Mormon story over and over again. I mean, that's all we do as Mormons. Even ex-Mormons live out the Mormon story. And so they're doing this. They're just playing out the Mormon narrative over and over and over again. And so right now they're in the very messy, I would say, you know, the messy Kirtland era. And the rhetoric is the same. And they're building a lot of the same sort of structures. And of course, we know what happens with that. And maybe they'll move into this Nauvoo area. They are crowdfunding for a temple. And so that'll be interesting to see how that happens. And of course, there's a sense of persecution. There's a persecution complex that is, of course, very Mormon. And they feel persecuted by Latter-day Saints and their bishops and things like that. So to me, it's just following that trajectory. And so we look at what happened with that, and I think that's a good indicator for what's to come.
It's Lindsay Hansen-Park, Acting Director of Sunstone, host of the podcast Year of Polygamy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Joseph LeBaron, filmmaker with The Good Line. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Really appreciate it. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Zoe Wolf McGinn. Technical direction today from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.